A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the logistics of international property moves, specifically what happens behind the scenes when someone relocates their entire household across borders. He's in Israel, where North American immigrants frequently do what's called a lift, shipping their belongings through a moving company that handles everything from customs clearance to tax paperwork. But his real question is about the invisible machinery. Does the moving company work with a freight forwarder? Do home moves get consolidated on the shipping unit? What route is most typical? What happens when the van pulls away? And are there any moving companies that actually run their own freight forwarding operations and get more directly involved in the logistics?
This is one of those topics where the surface looks simple. You call a mover, stuff goes in a box, stuff arrives. But underneath, it's this entire parallel economy of consolidation, freight routing, and customs brokerage that the consumer never sees. And the answer to the first question, does the moving company work with a freight forwarder, is yes, almost always, but it's more layered than just yes.
Explain the layering.
A freight forwarder, in the strict sense, is the entity that books cargo space on a vessel and arranges movement from port to port. But in household goods moving, the company you hire, the origin agent, is rarely the freight forwarder themselves. They coordinate with a forwarder who specializes in less-than-container load shipments because most household moves don't fill an entire 40-foot container. The forwarder consolidates multiple households into one box.
Your grandmother's china is sharing wall space with a stranger's exercise bike.
And that's the consolidation answer right there. The industry term is groupage. Multiple shipments, one container, one bill of lading per shipment, but one master bill for the container itself. The forwarder builds a consolidated container, and each household's goods are separated by plywood partitions or marked with different colored tape. It's basically a three-dimensional Tetris game played with other people's furniture.
Which explains why things occasionally arrive wearing someone else's packing label.
And that brings me to the root question. For U.S. to Israel moves, the overwhelming majority go by sea. Air freight exists, but it's astronomically expensive. $8 to $12 per kilogram versus maybe 40 to 60 cents per kilogram by sea. No normal person air freights their sofa.
Unless you're Elon Musk and your sofa is somehow also a rocket component.
Even then, he'd probably just build a new one at the destination. For sea freight, the typical route, the origin agent packs your house, loads the goods into a truck, and that truck drives to an East Coast consolidation warehouse, often in New Jersey or Baltimore. From there, the forwarder consolidates multiple shipments into a container, trucks it to the port of New York or Baltimore, and it sails to either Ashdod or Haifa. Transit time is roughly 3 to 4 weeks port to port, plus another week or two for customs clearance and final delivery.
That's where question three kicks in. The van pulls away, and then what?
What actually happens is the container doesn't go back to anyone. It was never the moving company's container to begin with. The moving company's truck brings your goods to the forwarder's warehouse, called a container freight station. The goods sit there until the forwarder has enough shipments to fill a container bound for Israel. Then they load everything, seal the container, and truck it to the port. The container itself is owned by the shipping line, Maersk, MSC, ZIM, and gets returned to them at the destination port after unloading.
The moving company's van isn't the start of a continuous chain. It's more like a feeder stream into a river system.
The van is a tributary. The river is the forwarder's consolidation network. But here's where it gets interesting, and this speaks to Daniel's fourth question about companies that handle their own forwarding. There are a handful of international moving companies that have vertically integrated. The big names, Allied, North American Van Lines, Crown Relocations. Some operate their own non-vessel operating common carrier licenses, meaning they function as their own freight forwarder without owning ships. They issue their own bills of lading, book directly with steamship lines, and run their own consolidation warehouses.
Non-vessel operating common carrier. That sounds like someone described a shipping company but forgot to buy the boat.
That's exactly what it is. An invoxy is a carrier to the shipper and a shipper to the carrier. To you, they're the shipping company. To Maersk, they're just a customer who buys container space in bulk. It's a legal fiction that lets them operate as a carrier without owning a single vessel. For household goods, this matters because an invoxy can consolidate their own shipments and control the entire chain from origin warehouse to destination warehouse. They're not handing your goods off to a third-party forwarder. They are the forwarder.
When Daniel asks whether any moving companies get more directly involved in logistics, the answer is yes, but it's the exception, concentrated among the large multinational movers.
And even then, they're still relying on shipping lines for the actual ocean transit. Nobody in household goods owns container ships. The vertical integration stops at the invoxy level. But the advantage is real. When one entity controls the consolidation, documentation, and customs brokerage, the handoff points where things typically go wrong are minimized.
Let's talk about those handoff points. What actually breaks?
The classic failure mode is the consolidated container where one household's customs clearance holds up everyone else's delivery. Picture four families' goods in one container arriving at Ashdod. Three clear customs in 3 days. The fourth family's paperwork has an issue. Maybe their inventory list doesn't match. Maybe customs randomly selected them for inspection. The entire container sits at the port until that one shipment is resolved. And the other three families have no idea why their stuff is delayed because the forwarder isn't going to volunteer that information.
Because admitting it was consolidated with a stranger's problematic shipment would raise uncomfortable questions about why that wasn't disclosed up front.
It's not even necessarily disclosed at all. Most moving contracts use language like combined transport or consolidated routing. The consumer sees a dedicated truck at their house and assumes dedicated everything. That truck is the last time their goods will have their own vehicle until final delivery.
The dedicated truck is a theatrical performance. The first and last mile are the show. The middle is a group tour.
And the first mile is genuinely dedicated. It has to be, because the crew is packing your specific house. But once those boxes hit the warehouse, they become inventory in a consolidation puzzle. The forwarder is looking at a booking for a 40-foot container to Ashdod, departure next Thursday, and they've got three partial shipments. Yours is 200 cubic feet, someone else's is 400, another is 350. They'll wait for one more shipment or top it off with a commercial shipment.
The container sits until it's full.
Or until the sailing deadline forces it to go. If the forwarder has a booking for a specific vessel, and the cutoff time is Friday at noon, whatever's in the warehouse by then goes. If your shipment arrived Friday at 1, it waits for the next vessel, which might be a week later. The consumer is told transit time is 3 to 4 weeks, but that clock starts when the container is sealed and on the water, not when the van pulled away from your house.
The promised timeline has an invisible preamble that can be anywhere from a few days to a few weeks.
The same thing happens on the destination side. The container arrives in Ashdod, gets trucked to a customs-bonded warehouse, and sits until all shipments clear. Then a local agent, a different company entirely, contracted by the forwarder, does the final delivery. The consumer thinks they're dealing with one company. They're actually touching four or five: the origin agent, the forwarder, the shipping line, the destination agent, and the customs broker.
Which brings me to the tax-free window Daniel mentioned. What's the actual mechanism there?
Israel has a specific benefit for new immigrants, olam, and returning residents. Under Israeli tax law, you're entitled to import your household goods duty-free within a specific window. For new immigrants, it's generally within 3 years of making Aliyah, though you can apply for extensions. For returning residents, it's within a certain period of returning, and you have to prove you lived abroad for a minimum duration. The key document is called a Tofes Tzahaf, literally yellow form, the Customs Exemption Certificate from the Ministry of Aliyah and Integration.
If you miss the window,
then you're paying purchase tax and VAT on the assessed value of your used furniture. Customs assesses used household goods at a depreciated rate, but it's still typically 17% VAT plus potentially additional purchase tax depending on the item category. On a full household shipment valued at, say, $40,000, that's nearly $7,000 in tax that could have been zero. And the window is strict. I've heard of people whose shipment arrived a week after their exemption expired and they had to pay the full amount.
That's a brutal cliff. 3 years minus 1 week is zero tax. 3 years plus 1 week, $7,000.
The burden is entirely on the immigrant to track this. The moving company won't necessarily remind you. They're not tax advisors. The customs broker might flag it, but by the time the broker is involved, the shipment is already at the port. If you're approaching the 3-year mark, you need to file for an extension before the shipment arrives, not after. The ministry is generally reasonable about extensions if you have a valid reason, but you have to ask.
The tax window isn't just a deadline. It's a planning constraint that should dictate when you schedule the move, not the other way around.
And this connects back to consolidation. If you're cutting it close to the deadline, you do not want your goods consolidated. You want a dedicated container that sails on a specific vessel on a specific date, because any consolidation delay could push you past the window. But dedicated containers for partial loads are expensive. You're paying for the empty space. So there's a trade-off between cost certainty and timeline certainty.
The cost of consolidation is unpredictability. The cost of dedication is paying for air.
Most people don't know they're making that trade-off because the moving company presents it as a bundled service. Here's your quote, here's your window, sign here. The quote doesn't itemize the forwarder's consolidation fee or the container sharing arrangement. It's a black box.
Let's get into the specifics of that black box. If I'm a moving company in, say, Teaneck, New Jersey, and I've just packed a 4-bedroom house bound for Ra'anana, what do I actually do next?
The Teaneck agent, let's call them a United Van Lines affiliate, has packed everything into what the industry calls lift vans. These are large wooden crates, typically 7 feet tall by 4 feet wide by 8 feet long. That's the standard unit for international household goods moves. The term lift comes from the fact that these are lifted by crane onto ships. Daniel mentioned the colloquial term, and that's the origin. The van line loads these lift vans onto a truck and drives them to the forwarder's warehouse, which for U.S. Israel moves is frequently in the Port Newark, Elizabeth Complex.
The lift isn't just slang. It's a specific physical unit.
It's the fundamental unit of international household goods shipping. One lift van is roughly 200 cubic feet, and you can fit about 10 in a 40-foot container. A typical 4-bedroom house might be 6 to 8 lift vans. At the warehouse, the forwarder receives your lift vans, checks them against the packing list, and assigns them to a consolidation. They'll group your 6 vans with 4 vans from another family and maybe 2 from a third. 12 vans total, container is full, seal it, and it goes to the port.
At this point, has anyone from the moving company actually seen the inside of the container?
The forwarder's warehouse crew has, but the origin agent who packed your house has not. The origin agent's responsibility ends at the warehouse door. After that, the forwarder's insurance and liability kick in, which is a whole separate layer of complexity. Most household goods moves are insured under an all-risk policy, but all-risk doesn't actually mean all-risk. Mold, mildew, and damage from improper packing are typically excluded. And if something gets damaged in a consolidated container, there's often a dispute about whose insurance covers it, the forwarders or the origin agents.
The finger-pointing phase of international logistics.
Which is why the vertical integration question matters so much. When one company controls the whole chain, there's no one to point fingers at. If something breaks, it's their problem. But when you've got an origin agent, a forwarder, a shipping line, a destination agent, and a customs broker all pointing at each other, the consumer is stuck in a Kafka loop with a broken armoire.
The armoire isn't answering emails.
No, but the claims adjuster is, and they're asking for photographs of the original packing, which the consumer doesn't have because they were busy watching the crew wrap their life in brown paper.
Practically, if someone is planning this kind of move, what should they be looking for in a moving company to avoid the Kafka loop?
The single biggest thing is to ask whether the company handles freight forwarding in-house or subcontracts it. If they subcontract, ask who the forwarder is and research them separately. A good moving company will tell you, a bad one will deflect. Second, ask about consolidation explicitly. Will my goods share a container with other shipments, and if so, how many? The answer should be a specific number, not a vague reassurance.
If the answer is, we don't consolidate, they're either lying or you're paying a premium for a dedicated container you may not need.
Or, they're an INVOC that runs their own dedicated consolidation, which is different from sharing a container in the general sense. If they're an NVOCC, they're consolidating their own shipments, which means full control over the process and a direct incentive to get it right. If they're handing your goods to a third-party forwarder who's consolidating shipments from multiple origin agents, you're one of many customers in a pool and your leverage is diluted.
The distinction between consolidating your own and being consolidated by someone else. It's the difference between carpooling and being put on a bus.
That's a perfect analogy. Carpooling, you know the other people and you have some control. Bus, you're just a passenger and the route isn't yours to choose.
Let's talk about the destination side. Because Daniel's prompt focuses on the origin logistics, but half the complexity happens after the ship docks. What does the destination agent actually do?
The destination agent is the mirror image of the origin agent, but with customs authority layered on top. When the container arrives in Ashdod, the destination agent receives the manifest and bills of lading from the forwarder. They file the customs declaration, the tofez, tzahav, plus a detailed inventory in Hebrew, and coordinate with customs for inspection. Israeli customs operates on a risk-based system. Some shipments clear on documentation alone. Others are flagged for physical inspection, which can be a full unpacking or a spot check.
If your shipment is consolidated with someone else's, and their shipment gets flagged,
everyone's shipment gets unpacked, because customs isn't going to sort through a consolidated container to find the one flagged shipment. They'll pull the whole container, and the destination agent has to hire a crew to unpack, present, and repack. That cost gets billed back to the flagged shipment's owner if the flag was specific to them, but if it's a random inspection, the cost is typically shared or absorbed by the forwarder. Either way, it's a delay for everyone.
Consolidation creates a collective risk pool. One person's customs flag becomes everyone's delay.
That's never disclosed in the moving quote. The quote assumes smooth customs clearance for all consolidated shipments, which is an optimistic baseline. Israeli customs inspects roughly 15 to 20% of incoming household goods shipments, according to the freight forwarders I've talked to. So in a container with four households, there's a better than even chance that at least one gets inspected.
Better than even chance of a delay that nobody budgeted for. That's not a bug. It's a feature that benefits the forwarder by making the baseline quote look cheaper than the real expected cost.
It's not unique to Israel. Every country has its own customs risk profile. Moving to Australia, the big risk is biosecurity inspection. They'll flag anything with organic material. Moving to the UK, the post-Brexit customs regime has added layers of documentation that didn't exist before 2020. Every route has its own hidden cost structure.
The global patchwork of customs anxiety.
The moving industry has evolved to manage it, but not necessarily to disclose it. The business model depends on consumers not understanding the complexity, because if they did, they'd ask harder questions and demand more guarantees, which would compress margins.
What does the ideal move look like, from a logistics standpoint, if someone is willing to pay for transparency?
The ideal move starts with an origin agent who is also an NVOCC, so there's no handoff to a third-party forwarder. The goods are packed into lift vans at the house, trucked to the company's own warehouse, consolidated only with other shipments that the same company controls, and loaded into a container that sails on a specific vessel with a confirmed sailing date. The destination agent is either a branch of the same company or a long-term exclusive partner with a direct contractual relationship. And the customs broker is in-house or tightly integrated, so documentation issues are caught before the container sails, not after it arrives.
How many companies actually operate that way for U.S. to Israel moves?
The big international van lines, Crown, Allied, Santa Fe, have the infrastructure for this on major routes. But U.S. to Israel is not the highest volume route, so even they may rely on partners on one end or the other. The truly integrated experience is more common on high-volume corridors like U.S. to U.K. or U.S. to Australia. For U.S. to Israel, you're more likely to get a hybrid, an INVOC origin agent who partners with a trusted destination agent in Israel, which is still better than the full subcontracting chain but not quite the seamless ideal.
The price difference between the ideal and the typical.
Hard to quantify precisely because quotes are bespoke, but anecdotally, integrated NVOCC moves run about 15 to 25% higher than the subcontracted alternatives. On a full household move that might cost $8,000 to $12,000, that's an extra $2,000 to $3,000 for peace of mind and a meaningfully lower risk of delay.
Which, in the context of a life-changing international relocation, is not an insane premium.
It's not. But most people don't know to ask, so they take the lower quote and absorb the hidden costs later. The moving industry is a market for lemons in the Akerlof sense. The information asymmetry between buyer and seller is so extreme that the bad drives out the good. The transparent integrated operators have to compete on price with the subcontracting networks that quote lower and deliver worse, and the consumer can't tell the difference until something goes wrong.
The used car problem. But the car is your entire household, and it's floating somewhere in the Mediterranean.
You can't kick the tires because the tires are in a sealed container that you're not allowed to open until customs clears it.
Let's get into the physical specifics of the lift van itself, because we've mentioned it as the fundamental unit, but I want to understand what's actually inside one of those crates.
A lift van is essentially a plywood box reinforced with a wooden frame lined with water-resistant paper on the inside. Standard dimensions are about 7 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and 8 feet long, roughly 200 cubic feet. They're built specifically for each move by the packing crew, not prefabricated. The crew constructs them on-site or in the truck, loads them, and seals them. The exterior is marked with the shipment number, destination, and contents category.
It's bespoke carpentry for every move.
It is, and it's one of the reasons international moves are expensive. The packing crew isn't just wrapping dishes. They're building custom crates for furniture, custom boxes for artwork, and custom lift vans for the bulk of the household goods. The materials alone, plywood, lumber, screws, waterproof lining, packing paper, can run into the hundreds of dollars for a full household.
All of that wood arrives in Israel, and then what? Does it get reused?
The destination agent unpacks the lift vans at delivery and disposes of the materials. In Israel, that means paying a disposal fee, which is typically included in the destination charges, but not always. Some companies reuse lift vans if they're in good condition, shipping them back empty, but that's rare on the U.S. to Israel route because the backhaul economics don't work. There's not enough volume going the other direction to justify shipping empty crates.
The lift van is a single-use product. Built in New Jersey, dies in Ra'anana.
The Mayfly of International Logistics. Lives for 6 weeks, accomplishes one thing, then becomes landfill.
There's something almost poignant about that. A custom structure built to protect your grandmother's china for exactly one journey, and then discarded.
The industry has tried to move toward reusable plastic containers, but the international dimension complicates it. You can't easily ship empty containers back across the ocean, and plastic crates don't break down flat the way plywood can be dismantled. So the disposable plywood model persists because the alternative requires a circular logistics chain that doesn't exist at scale. And the environmental cost is not trivial. A full household move probably generates several hundred pounds of wood waste and packing material at the destination.
The hidden environmental cost of starting a new life.
Which connects to the consolidation question in an interesting way. A fully consolidated container is more environmentally efficient per household than a dedicated one because the container space is used more completely and the per household share of ocean freight emissions is lower. So the cheaper option, consolidation, is also the greener option, but it comes with the delay and customs risk we discussed. The premium option, dedicated container, is worse for the environment but better for timeline certainty. There's a genuine trade-off there that nobody talks about.
The green option is the unpredictable one. The predictable option is the wasteful one. Choose your poison.
The industry won't frame it that way because it complicates the sales pitch. They'd rather sell you on the dedicated truck at your house and let the rest be invisible.
Let's pivot back to the freight forwarder relationship, because I think there's a distinction Daniel's prompt is circling that we haven't fully unpacked. He asks whether the moving company works with a freight forwarder, and then separately asks whether any moving companies have their own freight forwarding operations. There's a spectrum here, and I want to map it.
The spectrum runs from fully subcontracted to fully integrated. At the fully subcontracted end, you have a local moving company that handles the pack and first mile trucking, then hands everything to a freight forwarder who handles literally everything else. Consolidation, ocean booking, documentation, destination coordination. The local mover is essentially a packing service with a truck. At the fully integrated end, you have an Envoxy moving company that packs, consolidates, books ocean freight directly, handles documentation in-house, and either owns or has an exclusive relationship with the destination agent. In between, you have various hybrids. The mover might handle consolidation but subcontract ocean booking, or handle everything on the origin side but use a network partner for destination.
The consumer's ability to distinguish between these tiers is essentially zero without asking very specific questions.
Which is why I always tell people to ask two questions: who issues the bill of lading, and who is the customs broker at destination. If the bill of lading is issued by a company you've never heard of, that's the forwarder, and you should find out who they are. If the customs broker is a separate entity from the destination agent, you've got another handoff point. The ideal answer is, the bill of lading comes from the moving company itself, and the customs broker is in-house or directly contracted.
What does the bill of lading actually do, for someone who hasn't spent their career reading shipping documents?
The bill of lading is the fundamental contract of carriage. It serves three functions. It's a receipt for the goods, evidence of the contract of carriage, and a document of title, meaning whoever holds the original can claim the goods at destination. In a household goods move, it lists the shipper, consignee, ports of loading and discharge, vessel name, container number, seal number, and a description of the goods. It's the single most important document in the entire move, and most consumers never see it because it's handled between the forwarder and the destination agent.
The document that proves you own your own stuff, and you never lay eyes on it.
If there's a dispute, damage, loss, delay, the bill of lading governs liability. Under the Hague-Visby rules, the carrier's liability is limited to a specific amount per kilogram unless you declare a higher value and pay additional freight. For household goods, that limitation is laughably inadequate, maybe $2 per kilogram, which is why you need separate insurance. But the insurance claim still references the bill of lading, and if there's a discrepancy between what the bill of lading says and what you claim was shipped, you've got a problem.
The bill of lading is both the proof of ownership and the liability ceiling, and it's handled entirely by entities you didn't hire directly.
Which is why the integration question matters so much. If the moving company issues its own bill of lading as an NVOCC, they're the carrier for liability purposes, and you have a single point of recourse. If the bill of lading is issued by a third-party forwarder, you have to pursue a claim against an entity you have no direct relationship with, through the moving company that may or may not advocate effectively on your behalf.
The chain of accountability is only as strong as its weakest contractual link.
In the subcontracted model, the weakest link is often the one between you and the entity that actually lost or damaged your goods. You didn't hire them. You hired someone who hired someone who hired them. Your contract is with the origin agent. Their contract is with the forwarder. The forwarder's contract is with the shipping line. Somewhere in that chain, your standing wardrobe became a pile of splinters, and nobody's contract clearly says it's their fault.
The splintered wardrobe of international jurisprudence.
There's probably a law review article in that exact title.
Let's talk about something practical that Daniel didn't explicitly ask, but that I think is implicit in the prompt. What should someone actually do to prepare for this kind of move beyond choosing the right company?
The single most important thing is the inventory list. Israeli Customs lives and dies by it. It needs to be in Hebrew, itemized by box number, and accurate. If box 17 says kitchen utensils and Customs opens it and finds a television, you've earned yourself a full inspection and possibly a fine. The packing crew will create an inventory in English, but you need a Hebrew translation, and you should review it before submission. Don't trust the moving company to get the Hebrew right. They're using a template, and errors are common.
The consumer's job is to be the Hebrew language quality control for a document they didn't create.
Yes, and it's tedious but essential. Second is the Tofes Tzahaf, the tax exemption form. Start that process months before the move. It requires documentation of your aliyah or returning resident status, and the ministry can take weeks to process. You want the exemption certificate in hand before the shipment sails, because if there's a problem, you want to fix it before your goods are sitting at Ashdod accruing storage fees.
Storage fees are what, exactly?
After a certain number of free days, typically 5 to 7, the port or customs bonded warehouse starts charging daily storage. It's not ruinously expensive, maybe 50 to 100 shekels a day, but it adds up if customs clearance takes weeks. And the storage clock starts when the container is unloaded, not when you're notified. I've heard of cases where the notification was delayed and the consumer got a storage bill for 2 weeks. They didn't know they were accruing.
The meter is running before you even know the taxi has arrived.
You're paying for the taxi to sit in the parking lot. The third practical thing is to photograph everything before it's packed, every piece of furniture, every electronic device, every valuable item. If something arrives damaged, you need proof of its pre-move condition. The insurance adjuster will ask for this, and if you don't have it, they'll assume the damage was pre-existing. Your smartphone camera is the cheapest insurance policy you'll ever buy.
A full photographic inventory of your life, taken in the chaos of packing. What could go wrong?
It's a pain, but it's the difference between a successful claim and a denied one. Do it room by room, systematically, before the packing crew arrives. Once they're there, the house becomes a tornado of brown paper, and you'll never get clean shots.
The pre-move checklist is Hebrew inventory, tax exemption certificate, photographic evidence, and a moving company that can answer the integration questions without deflecting.
Lots of patience. International moves are fundamentally unpredictable. You can do everything right and still hit a port strike, a customs backlog, or a vessel delay. The best you can do is minimize the variables you control and build buffer into your expectations.
The serenity prayer of global logistics. Grant me the serenity to accept the delays I cannot control, the courage to photograph the furniture I can, and the wisdom to know the difference between an NVOCC and a subcontractor.
I put that on a poster. But seriously, the difference between a smooth move and a nightmare is often just one or two decisions made months before the truck arrives. The time to research the logistics is not the week of the move. It's when you're still in the planning phase, still comparing quotes, still asking the questions that most people don't know to ask.
Which is exactly why Daniel sent this prompt, I suspect. He's not asking about the consumer experience. He's asking about the machinery underneath it. Because understanding the machinery is what lets you make better decisions on the surface.
The machinery, as we've mapped it, is a patchwork of independent entities held together by contracts and customs, with the consumer standing at one end and their household goods somewhere in the middle, visible only through paperwork and tracking numbers. It's a marvel that it works as often as it does.
The miracle of international logistics is not that it's sometimes bad, it's that it's usually fine. Millions of households move across borders every year, and most receive their stuff in roughly the expected condition and time frame. The system is opaque and the incentives are misaligned, but the baseline outcome is surprisingly functional.
Which is a testament to the freight forwarders and destination agents who do this every day. They're operating in a high-complexity, low-margin environment with demanding customers and unforgiving timelines, and they mostly get it right. The horror stories are real, but they're the exception. The rule is that your stuff shows up, maybe a week late, maybe with a scratch on the dining table, but it shows up.
The banality of successful logistics. The container arrives, the lift fans are opened, the furniture is reassembled, and life continues in a new country. The miracle is invisible precisely because it works.
The people who make it work. The warehouse crews, the crane operators, the customs brokers, the delivery teams. They're the invisible infrastructure of every immigrant story. Nobody names a street after a freight forwarder, but every street in Ra'anana is lined with furniture that crossed an ocean because someone knew how to book a consolidated container and file a customs declaration.
The unnamed logistics coordinator behind every successful Aliyah. There's a book in that.
There's probably several, but they're all published by niche industry presses and nobody reads them.
Which is why we're doing this episode. Someone has to read the niche industry press, so the rest of us don't have to. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, astronomers in Bhutan reported a recurring radio signal that appeared to emanate from the same patch of sky every 17 hours and 43 minutes, but only during the monsoon season. The phenomenon was documented for 6 consecutive years and then abruptly stopped, with no explanation ever found. The logs refer to it only as the Whisper of the Eastern Pass.
The phrase Whisper of the Eastern Pass is going to stay with me in a deeply uncomfortable way.
Monsoon-only radio astronomy in 1840s, Bhutan is not a combination of words I expected to hear today.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the show running and apparently for unearthing deeply unsettling astronomical footnotes. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird promise, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.